This penalty should serve as a wake-up call to all pipeline operators.
BP pays a big fine for a large North Slope spill. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, the 3rd of May. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, cleaning up an old military site on Umnak Island.
It's very expensive when you start talking chemical warfare munitions just to get out there with the type of disposal equipment that's needed.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Quitting tobacco is the best thing you can do for your health. Join a free program that will help you create an easy-to-follow plan to quit. It will show you how to get ready, take action, and then live the rest of your life as a non-smoker. Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line provides 8 weeks of patches, gum, or lozenges, and quit coaches that are trained to address Alaskans, including expectant mothers. There's more information at 1-800-QUIT-NOW or visit AlaskaQuitLine.com. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line. It's free, it's confidential, and it works.
BP Alaska has agreed to pay $25 million in civil penalties for a 2006 oil spill on the North Slope. Federal officials are also requiring the company to beef up inspections and preventative maintenance on its hundreds of miles of pipe. APRN's Libby Casey reports.
Investigators say the 5,000 barrels of crude oil leaked because BP failed to prevent corrosion in its Alaskan pipeline system. The Justice Department got involved when the company didn't follow orders to improve its maintenance in the aftermath. Assistant Attorney General Ignacio Moreno says the civil penalty announced Tuesday equals out to be the largest per barrel amount the U.S. has ever assessed for an oil spill.
This penalty should serve as a wake-up call all pipeline operators that they will be held accountable for the safety of their operations and their compliance with the Clean Water Act, the Clean Air Act, and the pipeline safety laws.
Moreno says BP must also start an aggressive inspection and prevention maintenance program for its pipelines.
This agreement will protect the fragile tundra of Alaska's North Slope from oil spills by requiring BP Alaska to adopt a comprehensive inspection and preventative maintenance program throughout BP Alaska's 1,600-mile North Slope pipeline system.
Moreno says that will likely cost $60 million on top of $200 million the feds estimate BP has already spent. BP Alaska spokesman Steve Reinhart says the company has actually spent more than $500 million already. He would not go on tape with APRN, but said BP has been on what he calls a steady improvement track dating back to before 2006 when they had the spill. Lois Epstein, the Arctic Program Director for the Wilderness Society in Anchorage, says the order for BP to develop a better management system for its pipes should be a long-term investment.
They will be fairly costly to carry out, and my hope is that the federal government, through ensuring that this settlement agreement is carried out, will make sure that everything's done properly. And that includes things like replacing pipelines should they require replacement rather than repair. Other things that might not have happened if we were just relying on, for example, the state regs.
Epstein is trained as an engineer and says the settlement has long-term implications not just for BP, but for all operators on the North Slope. She says a large part of the agreement covers managing the integrity of pipes. While the federal government does that on major oil pipelines, it doesn't on BP's smaller ones closer to the wellheads up on the North Slope.
A lot of folks don't realize that near the wells, the three-phase pipelines, in other words, the ones that contain crude oil, gas, and produced water, all those pipelines are not regulated by the federal government. What the settlement does is it does put some specific standards in place how to address those.
The deal struck between federal officials and BP is subject to a 30-day public comment period and final court approval. Meanwhile, BP is still involved in legal disputes over last year's Deepwater Horizon blowout that killed workers and gushed nearly 5 million barrels of oil into the Gulf of Mexico. In Washington, I'm Libby Casey.
The U.S. Army Corps of Engineers is planning what's called a remedial investigation at Fort Glenn, a former defense site on Umnak Island. The goal is to figure out what military contaminants have been left there. KUCB's Alexandra Gutierrez has more.
Umnak Island in the Eastern Aleutians is home to a cattle ranching operation, an active volcano, and just a couple dozen people. But during World War II, the island was used as a defense garrison and army airfield. The site provided support to the nearby Dutch Harbor Naval Base, and counterattacks against the Japanese were launched from there. Today, dangerous military materials can still be found. This summer, the Army Corps of Engineers will try to determine what's left and where using environmental sampling. That information will let them decide what sort of cleanup is needed on the island. Here's project manager Kerry Kosseboom.
We need to get a good handle on how much of this is remaining so that we can plan subsequent year removal actions, because it's very expensive when you start talking chemical warfare munitions just to get out there with the type of disposal equipment that's needed.
This isn't the first time the Corps has looked for contaminants on Umnak. About 10 years ago, they investigated for fuel and hazardous chemicals. The last work done there on this issue was conducted by the Army EOD, or Explosive Ordnance Disposal Unit.
There was a response back in, I think it was 2004, when the Army EOD went out there to look at some reported pits that had some bombs in them, and they did a removal action, which means they actually blew them up, but they didn't complete the job.
Now the Army Corps will pick up that work again, and they'll devote extra time to looking for chemical warfare materials that might be on the island, like mustard gas.
There was a university professor from Maryland, Dr. Calkins. He contacted the Corps in 2002, and he suggested that before he left the island, that he was directed to bury some ordnance rounds of mustard gas. And they were fearful that the Japanese might take over the island, so rather than leave them for the Japanese, they decided to bury them. And this was not known to us until 2002.
According to Kosseboom, ranching operations will not be affected. In Unalaska, I'm Alexandra Gutierrez.
The flood threat, which prompted an evacuation notice last night for an area of Salcha, subsided some this morning. A new ice jam on the Tanana River flushed another large volume of water into Pile Driver Slough late yesterday, flooding yards and portions of the old Richardson Highway. But Salcha Fire and Rescue Chief Jim Scott-Nicky says it appeared this morning that the latest jam had released.
From the road, we're able to say it looks like it's clear and the level, last night, the water was up to almost to the real Richardson Highway, and this morning going by, it's down about 4 feet. So until we get out there and take a look, I don't know exactly what's going on, but I can tell you that it looks like it's gone down quite a bit from last night on the Tanana.
Levels on the Tanana at Salcha fluctuated yesterday as the two separate ice jams backed up water and released. But Scott-Nicky says the large volume of water they forced into the slough continues to cause problems.
All the water that has been going into the Pile Driver Slough is still there. And there's pretty heavy flooding, and I'd say moderate flooding. The road in many areas has up to a foot and a half of water at least. And from Boondocks all the way down to Stringer Road, we should consider that road impassable. I would encourage people to not try to get through there because the roadbed underneath is probably very soft. So I think we're in a draining stage for now, but there is a lot of water in the slough.
Scott-Nicky says several homes are surrounded by water and that some residents evacuated last night. He says concerns remain about additional ice coming down the Tanana, creating a new ice jam and sending another wave of water into the slough. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a new frontier of green jobs as the climate warms.
You think of GIS experts mapping things out, hydrologists measuring water temperature, project managers mapping out what a road removal project might look like.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein. Attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com. And by
Crowley, providing tanker escorts, fuel delivery, and energy support services to Alaskans for over 50 years. From Valdez to the North Slope, Crowley knows Alaska. Crowley.com.
Lawyers from around the state will be in Fairbanks this week for the Alaska Bar Association's annual convention, but some of them won't be attending the keynote speech by a controversial former U.S. official. KYC's Tim Ellis reports.
Longtime Fairbanks attorney Charlie Cole was still not sure last week whether he was going to sit in on the keynote speech to be given Friday night at the Bar Association's awards dinner. That's the event at the end of the annual convention when the 4,000-member bar recognizes its best and brightest, the event that this year features former U.S. Deputy Assistant Attorney General John Yoo.
Well, let's put it this way. Maybe I have something better to do with my time than to listen to him speak.
Cole is among the many members of the Alaska Bar Association who don't want to hear you speak and who have threatened to boycott or stage protests at the event. Because they say to sit in on the speech would be to lend tacit support to you and his controversial views on the law related to the powers of the president, specifically wartime powers, which you says authorize, among other things, so-called enhanced interrogation, which Cole and many others call simply torture.
I really have no desire to hear a former official in the United States Department of Justice tell us that waterboarding is perfectly legal. Torture is perfectly legal.
Cole has been practicing law for decades here in Fairbanks. He served as an assistant attorney general in 1954 and 55, when Alaska was still a territory, and as attorney general in 1990 through 94 under Governor Wally Hickel. Cole's concerns are shared by many other lawyers who argue that the opinions given in 2002 by you while serving in the U.S. Attorney General's Office of Legal Counsel undercuts the foundation of many essential American legal principles. Perhaps the most well-known of those opinions were spelled out in the so-called torture memo. That's the legal opinion that you gave to former President George W. Bush that provided a legal basis for waterboarding and other interrogation techniques used on foreign combatants captured in the War on Terror. The Justice Department later reconsidered and rejected Yu's legal opinions on the issue. Military lawyers in particular have criticized Yu's opinions, both because they say it makes torture more likely to happen to U.S. military personnel when they're captured, and because it conflicts with U.S. military law and international laws of warfare. Chris Zimmerman is a Fairbanks lawyer who's practiced military law while serving as an attorney in the Army's Judge Advocate General Corps. Zimmerman says he won't be among those who will be boycotting the speech because he says, despite one's own opinions, it's important to hear what Yu has to say.
Well, I mean, I'd kind of always interested in hearing other people's views on things, whether I agree or not.
Zimmerman says, however, he understands why some in the legal community don't want to hear you. And yet, Zimmerman says those attorneys should attend the speech.
Certainly, if you're or of the opinion that what he might have espoused or what might have been done as a result of advice that he gave was inappropriate, what better opportunity to question him?
Jason Weiner, another Fairbanks lawyer who's the Bar Association president, says that's why he decided to go along with the majority of the bar's executive committee, which voted late last year to invite you.
We're here to hear interesting discussions. Bar Association and the Bar Convention should be about discussing legal issues.
Weiner says Yu's invitation was intended to provoke debate, not to signal support.
It in no way endorses him or his beliefs. You know, we have invited numerous people. We've had justices, we've had judges, we've had commentators. They've all had different political views.
In response to the controversy, the Bar Association has scheduled a Friday morning panel discussion between you and Steve Wax, an Oregon public defender who has represented detainees being held at the Guantanamo Bay detention facility. Wax has written a book about what he says is an erosion of U.S. laws and civil liberties due to the war on terror. Wax also is scheduled to speak at a Friday evening potluck sponsored by the Alaska ACLU and the Unitarian Universalist Fellowship. In Fairbanks, I'm Tim Ellis.
Sitka was officially named a Coast Guard city on Saturday. The designation belongs to only 12 communities in the country and is awarded by the Coast Guard to signify a close bond between the military branch and the communities in which it serves. KCAW's Ed Ronco has more.
Last July, a Coast Guard helicopter carrying four people from Air Station Sitka crashed in Washington State. Three on board died, and a fourth crew member was injured. In Sitka, candlelight vigils were held, and memorial signs popped up in storefront windows. And hundreds of Sitkans attended the public memorial held a few days later. Coast Guard Captain Norman Custard is chief of staff for the Coast Guard District 17, which covers all of Alaska. At a reception after Saturday's award ceremony, he said the response to the crash demonstrated the love Sitka has for the Coast Guard, but the process of designating Sitka a Coast Guard city began long before the tragedy. He pointed to small, everyday things that he says make Sitka stand out.
Common courtesies, and the courtesies just saying hello to each other on the street, that goes a long ways. In this city, I mean, you walk everywhere down the street, everybody's got a smile on their face, they all say hello to each other, they help each other out.
Mayor Cheryl Westover put it this way.
There is no them and us attitude about Sitka's Coast Guard. Staff and families are fully integrated into Sitka life, in our schools, in our sports, our community organizations, and commissions. And as neighbors and friends.
No them versus us attitude might have been meant figuratively by the mayor, but Air Station Sitka Commander Doug Cameron says sometimes it's meant literally, too. During Sitka's 4th of July celebration, there was a contest between the Coast Guard and the fire department to see who could push a metal barrel further using fire hoses. Cameron joked about a problem he had right before the contest.
There are so many Air Station Sitka people that are members of the fire department that I show up at the fire station to divide into teams, and everybody's torn because there are so many people that are members of the fire station and the air station. It's like, well, who are you representing today?
He says beyond day-to-day life in Sitka, the feeling Coast Guard personnel get from the community keeps them here or brings them back.
Everybody wants to come here. Everybody likes the unit. Everybody likes the town. They like Alaska. And so it attracts the best and brightest in the Coast Guard. And they love living here. It's just cool. I love living here. Alaska is the only place that when I'm stationed someplace else, I miss. It feels more like home than any place else to me.
The proclamation designating Sitka a Coast Guard city came from Coast Guard Commandant Admiral Robert Papp, but was presented Saturday by Congressman Don Young.
And I'm especially fond of the Coast Guard. I've dealt with you for the last 55 years since I've been in Alaska. As a captain of a boat, sometimes you made me very angry. And sometimes I thanked you. All the time I have supported you.
All kidding aside, Young said the Coast Guard does important work that's essential to life in Alaska.
Each day we have someone goes to sea, someone is lost, someone has a perilous position as far as high seas. Somebody's moving into our waters, it shouldn't be, you're there. You're constantly on alert, and you're doing the job for this great state and this nation. And for that, I thank you.
Officially, Saturday's ceremony was the Coast Guard's chance to thank Sitka. But throughout the afternoon, it became clear that the appreciation was mutual. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Ed Ronco.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A. And by ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. The University of Alaska Fairbanks now offers both a Bachelor of Science and a Bachelor of Arts degree in fisheries. Begin your UAF fisheries degree at any major University of Alaska campus and finish in Fairbanks or Juneau. Learn more at www.uaf.edu/fish. The School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences, educating fisheries and marine science experts in Alaska for Alaska. This message sponsored by the School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences.
The Chugach National Forest, bordering Anchorage and stretching onto the Kenai Peninsula, is a natural place to study climate change. And a conference called Classrooms for Climate this week at the University of Alaska Anchorage is taking advantage of that opportunity. The conference is bringing in experts and youth delegates from around the world to examine the ecological changes taking place in the forest. One of those experts is J.P. Leas, an advisor for the Wilderness Society. He will speak about how climate change is creating jobs in areas you might not expect. He says the idea for the conference came about when people at UAA and at the Chugach National Forest started talking.
And the folks at the Chugach have long seen that forest as kind of a living classroom right in the backyard of Alaska's largest city. And the folks at UAA have often seen the Chugach as kind of a natural classroom. So, you know, these two groups kind of were talking about it. Well, geez, there's a lot of shared interest here. Thought, well, a conference seems like a good organizing vehicle to get a lot of experts talking together in terms of what do we know about the Chugach and how is climate impacting it? How can we get young people involved in protecting it, learning about it, and seeing their futures on the land, both in terms of the values they derive from it, but also the different types of jobs that they can have working out in the landscape? So that's kind of the genesis of how the Climate in the Classrooms conference started to kind of gel.
The idea of climate in the classrooms, are you... hoping for kind of promoting a concept of stewardship for young people so that they have more personal investment in where they live? Or is it an idea of helping them understand? I imagine it's all those things, helping them understand how climate is changing and what that means to the forest.
Absolutely. It's really kind of an all-of-the-above approach. The idea here is let's bring anthropologists, cultural experts, public health experts, educators, and all your science folks together and kind of see climate as a lens through which to view all these things so that it's not just an environmental issue, it's all these things together.
And the idea of a changing climate spurring potential jobs that are green jobs, give us an idea of what some of those may be. If there's any sort of silver lining in all of this at all, is it that there will be specialized jobs that are based on changes that we're seeing?
Absolutely. You hear the word or the phrase green jobs, and you think of solar panels, wind turbines, energy efficiency, building retrofits, and that certainly is all mission critical things. When I say green jobs, I think of jobs on the land. And you think of the different types of expertise that go into restoring our landscapes and keeping our wildlands and wildlife populations healthy in a warming world. And you think of GIS experts mapping things out, hydrologists measuring water temperature, project managers mapping out what a road removal project might look like, guys on backhoes getting the jobs done, folks in the back office making sure the purchase orders get paid, folks that are preparing the lunches for those work teams. And so there's kind of this spider-webbing economic impact when you invest in doing these restorative jobs in a climate-smart way.
Are you hearing any conversation about how this idea, this concept might translate itself into helping those in coastal communities in Alaska? Because as we know, they're getting hit the hardest and the soonest, the fastest by climate change. The erosion that's happening in these communities is a real life example of what we're looking at in the future. Has that been discussed, ways that there could be investment and jobs created to help in those kind of efforts?
Absolutely. Numerous agencies are thinking long and hard about that right now, and it's no doubt that it's going to be a huge investment. And we're already pretty much behind the eight ball in thinking about this stuff and investing and starting the projects. I think there's kind of two different maybe categories of ways that we can invest and create jobs and protect jobs. One, there's the work to be done in terms of the restorative work and the literally moving of communities back from the coastline, the restorative projects of buffering those coastlines and increasing their resiliency. So those are jobs that, you know, you can actually put boots on the ground today. Then there's the other side of protecting the economic value of those ecosystems. So you think of subsistence populations and the wildlife they depend on, the commercial fisheries that many of these folks depend on, you know, big dollar items. And so the projects that we look at in terms of helping communities deal with the impacts of climate change can also help protect the long-term economic values that these ecosystems have. So this is certainly stuff, issues that, you know, experts are thinking about, both in terms of, you know, your ecologists, your urban planners, your energy experts, as well as kind of your recreational and your fishermen, your outfitters, and those that depend on these resources for their livelihood.
J.P. Lias is speaking at the Classrooms for Climate Conference on Saturday, May 7th at 11:15 in the Lucy Cuddy Hall at UAA. The conference begins tomorrow and runs through Saturday. Alaska Native tribal leaders are meeting this week about unresolved issues of ANCSA, or the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act. The meeting will take place at the Millennium Hotel in Anchorage Thursday through Saturday. It follows a resolution made by Alaska tribes calling on Congress to restore Aboriginal land titles and hunting and fishing rights to Alaska's indigenous people. For Member Station KYUK in Bethel, Sophie Ivan reports.
The meeting will continue the discussion about children known as afterborns who were born after December 18, 1971, who do not have any shares or dividends of their own. There are approximately 75,000 afterborn children who must inherit shares from family members to be part of their corporations.
Five of my children and five of my grandchildren have no ties to our regional corporation, Chalista, and our village corporation, Kukahamut.
Mike Williams, Sr. of ACIAC.
They have absolutely no shares, and in the last dividend time, they didn't get any dividends.
Williams has long been an advocate of the Tribal Leaders Summit meetings that have been happening in Anchorage in recent years. He says it's a place for all tribal entities, regional nonprofits, and for-profits, as well as local tribes, to come together to address ANCSA and other issues. Another issue tribes have had with ANCSA is regarding subsistence hunting and fishing rights.
What ANCSA did was to extinguish the hunting and fishing rights, and we definitely disagreed with that. And ANILCA tried to fix that, but it didn't.
ANILCA, or the Alaska National Interest Lands Conservation Act, set aside lands for federal parks, refuges, and preserves. William says they will continue to try to restore subsistence hunting and fishing rights. Another topic to be covered at the tribal leaders' meeting is local law enforcement. William says the state's 229 federally recognized tribes have no jurisdiction to enforce laws at the local level. The keynote speaker is Native American advocate Ada Deer with the Menominee Tribe of Wisconsin. She's the former Assistant Secretary for Indian Affairs. Locally, she fought for years to restore her tribe's rights and getting its assets back to shareholders. Also presenting will be Emil Noddy, AFN's first president. I'm Sophie Van.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Alexandra Gutierrez in Unalaska, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Tim Ellis in Delta, Ed Rodko in Sitka, and Sophie Ivan in Bethel. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
First National Bank Alaska, serving Alaskans' financial needs for nearly a century. Member FDIC, equal housing lender. Northern Air Cargo. For over 54 years, Alaskans have entrusted Northern Air Cargo to transport their freight. Thank you, Alaska, for the opportunity to serve you for decades to come.
And by
Full Circle. Full Circle grows, picks, and delivers fresh, certified organic produce year-round. More information about their 400-acre farm and their organic partners at fullcircle.com.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.